Open Mind UFO Radio. This is your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I have with me Jason McClellan.
Yes, you do. I am here.
All right. How you doing, Jason?
I'm fantastic. Cool. The new week, and I am recharged and full of energy. Cool. Not really. That's the coffee talking. But.
Yeah, coffee does that. Makes you act funny.
Well, I always act funny. So.
Speaking of funny, actually, he's not so funny, but he's a great guy, our guest today, who is Ron Westrum, and he actually was a professor of sociology. He's worked a lot on the sociology of science and technology, which is really interesting, writing about mostly kind of like teamwork and stuff like that in the science field, including. He's written a couple of books, one of those on missile design at China Lake and how they work together well to create these missiles out there. But he also has been into UFOs his entire life and a MUFON consultant. And he's also observed sociologically the way people act to what he calls hidden events. So in other words, when something happens that is a scientific reality, but they don't know it at the time, how people react to it, including, as we know, how people reject those findings and that anecdotal information. So he's worked on a few really interesting cases, non-UFO related, but of course then he draws a parallel to the UFO field. So really interesting guy, and he is speaking at the Center for UFO Research Symposium, which is taking place in Greensboro, North Carolina, on June 29th and 30th. Our good friend Leslie Kane had a lot to do with putting together the speakers for this conference. It's got a lot of great people. Dr. Richard Haynes, Charles Halt, Nancy Talbot, Alexander Wentz, another guy who I believe is a professor, and then the general from Belgium, Jose Ley, who we've had on the show, who's a representative from Chile's official UFO investigation organization, a guy from JPON, a French UFO investigation group, General Jafari from Iran, very interesting, of course, the famous dogfight, Timothy Good and Dr. Jeffrey Bennett, so a lot of very credible and interesting people, definitely nuts and bolts, science kind of oriented thing. So it looks to be a great conference, and that's coming up. Also, Ron Westrum is speaking at MUFON, which is what, July 18th through the 21st. So it's kind of neat. He, of course, has great credentials being a professor. In fact, he got his PhD in social relations at University of Chicago, but he got his bachelor's at Harvard. So he's a very interesting person and all of a sudden kind of coming forward and talking more about UFOs. So that's who we're talking to today. Great interview. But before we get into that, we are going to talk a little bit about UFO news. And the first thing we do is ask Mr. McClellan, what is his story of the week? It's actually been 2 weeks because we took some time off for Memorial Day.
It has been 2 weeks, so do I get to pick from 2 weeks worth of news, Alejandro?
You certainly do.
Well, I'm not going to be that interesting. I'm going to pick a story from last week. I don't need to cheat here. My story, Alejandro, is going to be one that is about somebody who many of the listeners probably remember from early 2012. There were a lot of headlines about this guy. His name is Simon Parks, and he is he's on the town council in an English town in North Yorkshire called Whitby. Whitby is the town that he's a councillor in, and this guy has been very vocal about a lifelong experience with extraterrestrials. He claims that his mother is a 9-foot-tall extraterrestrial, and he's spent his life having various encounters with many different types of extraterrestrials. And he's been very open about this. It didn't stop him from being elected to office in 2012. And it's fascinating to see just the public's reaction, and really all we have to gauge is mainstream media and what they cover and how they report this. But from what we've been able to see, people seem very casual about it, and this doesn't really seem to affect their views of him as a politician. And his response to that is, hey, look, you know, it doesn't affect my professional life. It's just part of my life, but don't worry. And people seem to not let that bother them. But he's back in the news again because he's going to be the subject of a documentary being made for a television channel in the UK, Channel 4. And the show is titled Confessions of an Alien Abductee. And it's going to feature pretty much his life story, talking about experiences that he claimed go back even before he was born. He has memories, he claims, of these encounters pre-birth, however that works. But fascinating stories. He's kind of kept a book of his experiences, and he's got illustrations he made as a child showing his gigantic 9-foot extraterrestrial mother, and he tells stories of how he would encounter other extraterrestrials, and he would be afraid, so he'd hide underneath his mom's clothing. And then to show him that it was okay, she would magically make piles of toys appear and give him a chocolate bar, and he'd come out and he'd be happy and everything would be fine. So he an extraterrestrial encounter support group basically did a very long interview with him in 2012, and all these videos were put on YouTube by this group, and we had them all on openminds.tv. We can watch him, Simon Parks, telling his experiences and showing some of his illustrations, and it's pretty fascinating stuff. I don't know what to make of the guy, and you know, it's an interesting case. It's interesting that he is in the public spotlight in the local government there, and he's very vocal about his alleged experiences. So that's going to be made into a show, and we'll see. I wouldn't be surprised if that eventually makes its way across the pond, and we get to see that on TV here in the States. But that'll be, and there's no release date on it yet, but it should come out sometime this year, and that will air on Channel 4 in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that people don't seem to mind or make a big deal out of it, even though his claims are pretty wild.
Yeah, these are pretty, pretty intense claims that he makes. And yeah, it's not just one experience, something simple or vague like I was abducted by extraterrestrials. This lifelong story of multiple encounters and detailed stories. So yeah, you're right. It is pretty surprising that from what we can tell, it's kind of just taken in stride.
Well, and the other thing is, and I just found his name. I finally found our story on it. But in early 2012, there was a guy who was going to succeed someone else to a seat on the European Parliament. And that was postponed because of controversy around him being a UFO author, an expert,
author.
And they actually, at first, they were like, oh, it's not going to be any big deal. And then they postponed his taking the seat. And I don't know what eventually happened, actually. I never saw a follow-up to the story. But just because he had written a book and you know, been on some shows talking about the topic in general, there was problem there, but no problem with this guy who says he has memories of extraterrestrials before he was even born.
It's pretty interesting. I'm interested to see that this documentary is being made by a pretty decent production company off the fence over there in the UK. So I think they'll do a good job with it, and it's an interesting story.
Yeah.
I'd definitely be interested in seeing that
show. Yeah, so we'll see. We shall see.
Yes, sir. Well, Alejandro, you have 2 weeks' worth of news to choose from. What are you picking today?
Well, you know, I think the most recent thing, I guess we definitely got to talk a little bit about, because it's big this weekend, and I think we were one of the first to jump on it, thanks to Red Pill Junkie. But the video of the UFO over the...
Come on,
you know how
it.
To say it, but the let's see. I'm going to try.
I want to hear you say
it. I usually say Popocatépetl.
That is so close, Alejandro. I think we'll just go with that one. Right, actually, I want to hear you try
a
different one.
I can do it. I think I can really do it, though.
Okay,
Popocatépetl.
So close, so close. Okay. Ready? Popocatépetl.
Popocatépetl.
There you go.
Nice. You practiced it, right?
A long time ago, yeah.
Because there's been lots of stories about this thing, and there's a new video, some videos where people think this is an active volcano, where people think that there are UFOs flying around it in some of the videos. And I think this video that just came out late last week is actually probably the most spectacular of all of them, because it's a very bright object that is certainly zooming around. It flies in and then seems to fly into the volcano. So I'm really interested to hear more people's opinions.
Well, you're right. I like this one better because the object actually turns.
Yeah.
You see it change direction where the others, you know, they could be meteorites or things behind the volcano. They just kind of come from the sky and shoot down. Or this one's coming horizontally across the sky and turns midair. Mm-hmm. So
now I feel this is my, you know, non-expert opinion, although I've been looking at the videos for 10 years, and we'll see what you think. I think I'm fairly certain myself it's a bird. I think he's landing on the lip just inside of the caldera there. And the reason I say that is because I think you can see flapping on either side of the bird, although it would have to be pretty big, I guess, if it's this far from the camera. But I know, you know, Lee Spiegel from Huffington Post posted it this weekend, and he got a comment from Mark D'Antonio, who says he thinks the speed on the video is not accurate. I don't know if I agree with that, though. I guess we'd have to watch other video because the smoke seems to be at regular speed, but maybe it's not. He thought it might be a plane because he thought the flashing, the movement on either side wasn't wings. He thought those were lights from a plane.
And I seem to recall us hearing the time-lapse theory and the plane theory earlier than Mr. Mark D'Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, that was my theory.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I was going to let you express your theory.
Well, first of all, I see what you're saying with the bird, but wouldn't that bird have to have like an awesome futuristic bird thermal suit on not to get fried by landing that close to the volcano?
Well, the thing is the reason I think not is that those calderas are huge, and usually the hot portion of the caldera is only one portion. I mean, when you look in there in the volcanoes, you know, it's spewing, it's coming out of one section. So when you see the guys go around and on these things, you know, they can stand at the edge of the caldera as long as they're not on the hot end. And this bird probably, and it looks like it is landing on the opposite end of where the smoke is coming from.
Right. And Popocatépetl Mountain is pretty big. So, yeah, I can see that. And, so the reason I threw out the idea of just a commercial or just a standard airplane in the sky is that, to me, the video does look like a time-lapse video. You're right. The smoke does seem consistent with just a regular speed video. So we can't really tell. But the motion of the object going through the sky and the turn it makes, it looks like it is sort of a perspective issue here. It looks like a plane that's making an approach at an airport or something behind the volcano. Mm-hmm. There are airports around there, but not close. So I don't know. It's hard to tell distances there. I see also what you're talking about with the flapping, so I could see that as a possibility. But again, I'll point out this video is not the best of quality, so it is nearly impossible to make any of these determinations. These are just educated guesses.
Right, exactly. And, you know, just our opinion. So, you know, check out our story and tell us what you all think. Certainly some people think it's much more mysterious than what Jason and I are guessing here.
That's right.
All right, I did want to mention just quickly a couple of the other stories. I'm going to cheat because there have been 2 weeks. And I think this is a pretty important another one that Lee Spiegel wrote. And this is on this Attaboy, where essentially Ripley's Believe It or Not, a new book came out of Ripley's Believe It or Not. And it shows an image and talks a little bit about another Atacama humanoid. They even call it Attaboy because they found it in the Atacama Desert. And it's they believe is a fetal skeleton. They don't have it in their possession anymore, but the pictures were from a while ago. And luckily, Lee got a lot of pictures from the Ripley people. So he's got like a little slideshow of a dozen pictures on his website. But we also talked to him via video about this little guy. So that's kind of interesting in that there's a second mummified carcass in the desert.
Yeah, and, you know, that fuels speculation on both sides of the belief here with these little guys, the people who feel that these are nothing but mummified human remains. Say, see, there you go. There's another one. So not that unusual, mm-hmm. or not just that one Atta that we saw in Sirius, but others who strongly feel that these are extraterrestrials say, see, there's another one. So it's extraterrestrials. So
right. And I do want to say that, you know, in the video, Lee expresses some opinions. Some of which I agree with, some I don't, but, you know, I was just asking him the questions and letting him respond. And I do got to say, you know, he felt that the people who wrote the press releases for the Sirius movie did know that this thing was probably human, because that's what Dr. Nolan says. But I hold out, you know, I've had the benefit of interviewing a couple of the people from the movie, and I want to say I don't know that necessarily they were being malicious or doing these things just for marketing purposes. Maybe they didn't know, and I think that you know, they still hold some beliefs that this thing might not be human, which is of course their opinion and their right. So I don't necessarily know that they were being disingenuous or untruthful personally. So.
Right. Yeah, I don't either, but, it's impossible
to
tell.
Yeah, it is. But finally, I just want to mention also and get your opinion, because this is really funny. Our coworker, Antonio Juneas, who's been on the show multiple times, is being accused of being an extraterrestrial himself, possibly even reptilian, or under my control.
We've all been there.
Right. But there are some videos online of him sitting next to Stephen Greer at the citizen hearing, and he is making some weird faces. And people have zoomed in, and at least in one or two cases, it's just a joke. People are just being silly. But some people are being serious, and then Alfred Weber comes out and says it's clear evidence that him and Greer and Bassett are under mind control. And that is... I do not believe that Antonio is under any mind control. In fact, I know he was uncomfortable for reasons that I'll let him share should he choose to, but that he was uncomfortable, which was due to that's what created these funny faces. But you don't think that Antonio is a reptilian or under mind control, do you?
All the recent attention and the recent videos have made me question my beliefs, Alejandro.
They make you scared?
Questioning and wondering if there's something to these accusations, because I've noticed the oddities myself.
Yeah.
Now, Antonio is certainly not an extraterrestrial, in my opinion, but we'll ask him about
it. Yeah, he's not an alien. He's Chilean.
Chilean.
The people just got confused.
It's funny because they're, as you mentioned, there are these videos that people have posted zooming in on him from when he was at the citizens hearing. But, you know, people are also leaving comments on other videos on our YouTube channel, like his You Need to Know series. And they'll leave comments like, look closely, he doesn't blink once. And that's a valid point. Our friend Antonio doesn't like to blink for some reason, but I don't think that makes him an extraterrestrial.
No, he's all too human, as we know. We've spent many years now with our buddy Antonio. And
I mean, we could make the same argument for any of us.
Yeah.
You know, our good friend Maureen and I are excessive blinkers.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that means either.
And I got to say, you know, Alfred Weber, he posted something, he sent out something now just this weekend about some accusations against Greer and some Stephen Greer and things like this. But when he made these statements last week, and he continues to do this kind of thing, it calls into question his credibility. Because, I mean, he looks at these videos of people accusing Antonio of being reptilian and then automatically jumps at either ETs or the government are using mind control on him, and then we immediately hear these accusations from Greer about Greer, whether they're real or not. It's like, you know, difficult to take serious.
Right. Yeah, his emails have been pretty ridiculous, and I don't know what the motives are for those. You know, seem to be on sort of a tirade and a mission to kind of discredit people for whatever reason.
But then again, maybe we're under mind control of Antonio.
That's always a possibility.
Bum, bum, bum. All right. Well, thank you once again for a great conversation and some updates, Jason McClellan.
Thank you, Alejandro.
All right. Let's go ahead and listen to Ron Westrum. I am very excited to have Ron Westrum on the phone. Hello, Ron.
I can't pronounce it either.
Yeah, I stumbled a little bit there.
Yes, no problem.
So to start off, yeah, let's talk about some of your background and if you could tell us some of your history.
Right. Well, I was educated as a sociologist. I got an honors degree from Harvard back in the 60s, and then I got a PhD from the University of Chicago. And then I came to Eastern Michigan University, where I've taught for the last 40 years, with visiting appointments at Edinburgh and Hawaii and most recently in Norway. So I'm basically an organizational sociologist,
mm-hmm.
very, very interested in how organizations work. And I think even earlier than that, though, I got very interested in the topic of UFOs. So I thought, what can a sociologist do for the field of UFOs? And so what I did basically is I began to look at information flow about UFOs. Most of us tend to take for granted that we know what's going on with UFOs, but actually the truth of the matter is that the way that information flows in society about UFOs is something that very few of us have a good grasp on. Just a common example of this is what we think about the frequency of UFO sightings. Recently, there hasn't been a lot of coverage of UFOs in the newspapers, so we take it for granted that not much is going on. But what we don't realize is that between us and UFOs, the newspapers are interposed, and they have their own dynamics. So sometimes they talk about UFOs when UFOs are there, and sometimes they don't. The reality is that the frequency of UFOs has very little to do with the frequency of what we see of UFO stories in the newspapers. Now, this is also true of other organizations in society, and I think probably the one I can talk about the most is science, because we take it for granted that science is going to tell us about UFOs if UFOs exist, and that science is going to behave objectively, and it's going to essentially, you know, give us a straight story. Unfortunately, this expectation is not very realistic.
Right.
It's not how it works.
I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, it seems like there's a lot of misunderstanding about science, I think, in the general public, in that people kind of feel that there are scientists working on everything in every field, where that's not really the case. I mean, it's very directed and typically by funding.
Absolutely. And I think that, I spent a lot of my early career basically looking at the sociology of UFOs and similar anomalies, and especially the way that science would approach UFOs and anomalies. For instance, two of the studies that I carried out to try to give me a good picture of how science reacts were the study of the discovery of meteorites and the discovery of the battered child syndrome. Now, those two events took place roughly 200 years apart. But the interesting thing about it is that in each case, science reacted in ways that we really don't expect scientists to act. It didn't behave objectively. It didn't listen to what it was being told. And for the most part, often had a very bad idea of what was really happening.
Now, have you found there, why do you think that was in these cases? Is there a similarity between these two types of phenomena that, or kind of a reasoning why science kind of took that perspective when it came to these two issues?
Sure. The basic idea is what I call hidden events. Now, hidden events are basically things that are very widely experienced but very seldom reported. And I think that phrase actually comes from a book on near-death experiences by Raymond Moody. And Moody discussed in near-death experiences and said basically lots of people have these experiences, but very few people talk about them. So how does science react when it's faced with something that's widely experienced but not very well talked about? Well, the meteorite example is, for instance, a case in point. Back in the 18th century, scientists didn't believe that stones fell from the sky. And even when they were presented with stones supposed to have fallen from the sky, they looked at the stones and they said, nothing special here. Now, they were wrong, okay? But there were cases where literally scientists went into museums and there was a drawer, for instance, labeled stones from the sky, and they were thrown out because it was assumed that this was superstitious. Now, in 1790, there was a really egregious case of this kind of attitude, which took place in the south of France where they brew Armagnac. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but this is a very fine form of brandy. And basically one night, a huge meteor came over the south of France and blew up and dumped stones all over an area called La Grange de la Jouillac. Now, the name is not particularly important. This was a relatively small village, and stones fell everywhere. Basically, they fell on roofs, they hit cattle, there were holes in the ground and so forth. And so the locals were just absolutely amazed by this and began to talk about this to other villages and so forth. And finally, a scientist named Saint-Amand heard about this, and he thought it would be very interesting to actually get some sort of proof or something from them that these stones had really fallen. So he wrote to Lagrange and said, you know, what can you tell me about this? So what he got back in return was a filled-out legal form, a protocol, actually, signed by the mayor and the town attorney, and it was noted that 300 other people would be willing to sign this. So Saint-Amand didn't really know what to do with this, so he sent this on to a science journal, the Journal of Useful Sciences, and the editor, Bertillon, said, and this is pretty much an exact quote, he said, what can we say to this obviously wrong event? You know, it's one thing to have individuals making mistakes like this, but to have a whole community testify to this physically impossible event, he said, this is just beyond belief. So he didn't believe it. It was only in 1803 that there was a similar event, and this time it happened near the French Academy of Sciences, about 70 miles, if I recall, from Paris. And the Academy sent somebody to investigate, Jean-Baptiste Biot, who was an atmospheric scientist. And Mr. Biot quickly determined that this, in fact, was not a folktale, that stones had really fallen. And, of course, the most important thing was that an academician who happened to live near there had actually seen these things, you know, and so forth. So they, in 1803, then, the French accepted the reality of meteorites. In the United States, of course, there was another similar fall, I think, in 1807, and the president, Thomas Jefferson, was asked what he thought of these things. And he is reputed to have said, "I would rather believe that two Yankee professors could lie than that stones could fall from the air."
Okay. So it seems like in this case, then, it was kind of a situation where, and, you know, in modern times we wouldn't have as much insight, that society had a strong bias already that influenced science.
Not society, science.
Science itself.
Bias, okay? And I think this is important to understand, because scientists back then, and not it's not that different today, back then believed that basically society had to be protected against superstitious beliefs.
Mm.
And so they discounted basically the direct eyewitness accounts and so forth of ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting, by the way, before 1803, when this was basically becoming a controversy, that some scientists said, well, you know, what do you expect from people? For instance, if we take what people say about volcanoes, you know, they say all sorts of silly things. So we can, you know, we can't really trust ordinary people to tell us the truth when something like this happens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a similar case, although, you know, quite different in many of its respects, was the battered child syndrome and its discovery in the 1950s by the medical community. Now, here was something, again, which was, again, very difficult for medical people to take seriously, because the idea that parents would beat and abuse their children, often ferociously, actually, was something that most pediatricians, for instance, couldn't accept. So when radiologists began to detect what was clearly the result of some sort of abuse, the radiologists themselves were unwilling to go forward and say, well, this is, you know, this is really going on. And it took a pediatrician who was very interested in this and decided he was going to bang the drum that the radiologists had failed to do. This was Henry Kemp. He was actually a very famous man because he was a brilliant pediatrician. And he was head of pediatrics at the University of Colorado. And he got offended at first at what he said were the simply silly diagnoses of his residents when there was clearly cases of child abuse that they were inadvertently covering up. So he decided he would make a big fuss about this, and he was head of the Academy of Pediatrics one year. So he decided, since he had the choice of any session he wanted, that he would have a session on child abuse, and he decided to call it the battered child syndrome. So in 1960 then, at the Palmer House in Chicago, he had the session on child abuse in the Grand Ballroom, and he invited an interdisciplinary panel to about what they knew. There were about 2,000 people in the Grand Ballroom when this panel met, and after that it was very difficult to cover up child abuse, because as a result of Kemp's efforts, people began to realize that, you know, this was a very serious problem. But the most interesting thing to me was what pediatricians thought about the frequency of this. How often did child abuse take place? And so Kemp had actually hired a sociologist to do a little survey of police departments and hospitals and so forth, and came up with 700 cases nationally. Now, 700 sounds like a lot, but we know the real figure today is more like a million,
mm-hmm.
or upwards of that, okay? And there were pediatricians who were so unwilling to believe this that they literally would get up in a meeting and say, if I thought parents could do this to their kids, I'd get out of pediatrics immediately.
Wow.
All right.
And fortunately, it happened a lot.
Yes, unfortunately, this is quite a common event. And so is, by the way, sexual abuse of children.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about both of these cases is that in many respects, they had no idea what the frequency was. Even the people who were interested, even the pediatricians who were interested in this, had no idea how widespread these cases were. And if you told them that there were 1 million cases nationally, I think even the pediatricians would have said, oh, I don't believe it. But nobody asked them at the time, so it's hard to say what they really thought about this.
Right.
There were other pediatricians who said, well, maybe it's just bone fragility, you know, certain kids are just, you know, more likely to become bruised and so forth.
So these are two examples, but do you feel then this sort of thing happens with all hidden events?
Well, that basically defines what a hidden event is.
Okay.
A hidden event is something that is taking place in much greater frequency, sometimes by a couple orders of magnitude or even more than people think. A perfect example, let me give you one more example before we pass on here, and that's ball lightning. It used to be that ball lightning would be described as a rare physical phenomenon, okay? So some scientist decided he would do a little survey. So he took two national laboratories and did a survey and found that about 1 in 20 of the people in the laboratories had actually seen ball lightning. So 1 in 20 is not exactly a rare event, okay?
Right.
But the basic point was that that was what people assumed. Mm-hmm. So why is it that some scientists thought it was a rare event? And the answer, it goes back to the nature of hidden events, and that is that people don't really want to talk about stuff that they have trouble conceptualizing or believing and so forth. And the interesting thing, of course, is if I have an event and I don't talk about it, and you have an event and you don't talk about it, then we don't talk about it. So we both think that we're the only one that's experiencing this, if you catch my drift here. And so that's this problem of what's been called pluralistic ignorance is a very common one with hidden events, in that people really think that they're the only one that experienced this.
Right. Well, in these situations, too, it seems like these biases against these hidden events are pretty extreme. I mean, they seem to be unbalanced, like very strong. And, of course, then I'm sure they hamper the ability of real science to get done in these areas.
Well, yes, and it also has to do with what science thinks about its own processes.
Mm-hmm.
Because scientists think that if this stuff was going on, they would know. I call it the fallacy of centrality, okay? That so if things are going on, that they would be because they're the experts, that they would know. But the problem is, in many cases, of course, it's exactly because they are experts that they don't know. That is to say, people are unwilling to go to them and tell about this stuff because they are afraid of being ridiculed, which, of course, often happens.
Right. And in these cases, and I guess it becomes a problem even with that, with social sciences and psychology,
yes.
Science, of course, they want to replicate the situation, and in social situations, they can't. Or with a meteorite, it's not like you can go replicate that. Now, if they waited outside and watched, but these are, even with ball lightning, now we can, but they're not replicatable, which makes it even more difficult.
Yes, well, so the paradigm of science you're invoking is that we ought to be able to replicate, but that's experimental science.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with something like this, it's much more like clinical science, where you look for another case. And the truth of the matter is, the theoretical discovery of meteorites took place because, literally, there was a German scientist named Chladni, and he simply went down to the public library, and he read about it. And he said, after 2 weeks in the public library, it became absolutely clear to him that sometimes stone and iron masses fell down from the sky, often with a noise and so forth, and left fragments on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 1790, actually, 1791. He published a little book, and the little book he published was viciously attacked by people because they said, well, you know, this is just hearsay.
Right.
But he had it right.
Yeah, and by doing research, which brings me back to kind of transitioning over to the UFO topic then.
Sure.
For instance, what was it that you saw, you know, when you were younger that convinced you that this was a genuine phenomena worth studying?
Well, I never saw anything. I mean, I think the truth is what I did is I read other people, like pilots and things like that, who had seen mm-hmm. things. And that was what convinced me. And, of course, as an adult, and I spent many years, by the way, researching the history of guided missiles. And so I got to know the aviation community pretty well. I wrote a book on the Sidewinder missile, which actually did pretty well, mm-hmm. come to think of it. but the basic point is that when you begin to get reports like this from people who are technically trained, and especially people at, like pilots, for instance, who have opened fire with machine guns on these things, then, you know, you really can't come back and tell me, well, you know, the pilot was seeing some sort of aerial mirage, you know. That's not how it works. If you know anything about pilots and how they operate, or if you say, well, hey, you know, these radar things are just some sort of, you know, technical effect. This doesn't really happen. This doesn't collate basically with, you know, the reality of how technical systems and guided missile systems and things like that work. So I think the older I got, by the way, the more serious I took the UFO stuff. Even though I was, like many people, very depressed by the Condon report that came out in 1968. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the most interesting aspect of the Condon report is it said the UFOs do not menace national security in any way. Well, in 1968, Minot, North Dakota, the guided missile base, or the Strategic Air Command base, got an absolutely unreal UFO sighting. Where this bomber came in over the base at one point and saw this thing on the ground, 200 feet long and glowing like the sun. All right. Now, what was this? Well, this was a Strategic Air Command base. National Security and Strategic Air Command belong in the same sentence, right? So here was something which is unequivocally a menace to national security, and yet the Condon report was not revised because of the Minot case, and the Minot case was by no means alone.
Mm-hmm.
So the truth of the matter is that Dr. Condon, had basically lied to us. The Air Force investigation was a joke. And so just like science, we need to say, okay, well, what's the personal equation with the Air Force? Do they tell us the truth? Obviously not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they had been honest, they would have said, well, you know, we had this report come out and said there's nothing to it. But, you know, but then there's this Air Force base that was virtually invaded by this huge, huge thing.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to fit along the lines, of course, with the Robertson panel and their findings. And being a sociologist, you know, I'd love to hear your perspective on this, because they felt that regardless of the reality of the phenomena, that it was important for them to make it look like it's nothing, to dismiss it in order to keep from UFO reports coming in and getting cluttering up their military intelligence, which is kind of a sociological aspect and approach to all of this. How do you feel about their conclusion to do that, and do you feel that perhaps a situation like the Condon report was to meet those ends?
I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's no question that the Condon report was done by a university that the Air Force felt would come out with what they considered to be the right answer, namely that there was nothing there. And I think Richard Dolan's excellent books on the national security state and UFOs are absolutely on target. I know some of the people that he discusses in those books, and he has them down. He's quite right about it. So I think the truth of the matter is the Robertson panel, which was a CIA panel, is a perfect example of the fact that you can't trust science to tell you the truth when some other interest is involved. And so the idea that scientists are going to be objective is something that has to be accepted with a huge grain of salt. In fact, mm-hmm. I don't think we should accept it. In the long run, science might be objective. But scientists have other interests. National security is one of them. Money is another. And so I think it's important to take those motives into account.
Mm-hmm. Well, and these biases, for instance, with the child abuse, I mean, it's there's anecdotal information coming in that's not being trusted or put in high regard when the negative coming out of not looking into it, of course, is that more and more children are being abused by when this phenomenon is being ignored.
Yeah. Well, let me give you something that's an even more interesting example, because it shows the moral ambivalence of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I said that Henry Kemp had done some of the first investigations on physical abuse. But he and his colleagues knew perfectly well that there was a high degree of sexual abuse. But they literally sat on the information for 17 years.
Wow.
And the reason was very simple. He wanted the physical abuse stuff to be accepted, and then he brought forward the sexual stuff. Now, should he have spoken out earlier? You know, it's really, I think, a judgment. And I think I tend to side with Kemp. I think he was, you know, he's an extraordinary man. And, you know, I understand why he withheld that information. Mm-hmm. But I think what you need to understand is, so scientists then make strategic decisions about which information to release and which not.
See, and I think that has important implications in this field as well. And, well, I guess I'll go there. So, for instance, in this case, Kemp was essentially holding back that information because he didn't want to, it sounds like, hamper the community's acceptance of the physical abuse first.
Right.
And that if he came out with the sexual abuse information, it could have stymied and then further put back the seriousness on the physical abuse. So that's why he did this.
Yeah.
So in the UFO scenario, there's a debate that is similar. For instance, you are participating in a couple of conferences coming up in MUFON, and I think for me really exciting is one that Leslie Kane is helping out with, the Center for UFO Research, and it's very science-oriented. So the debate in this community when it comes to like the citizen hearing, which happened in Washington, is do we do the same thing? Do we make sure and focus on the UFO aspect with the mainstream so we don't stymie our movement with the mainstream by bringing on more fringe things such as abduction and alien contact and all of this sort of thing?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. As you mentioned, I was recently in France talking to some French ufologists. We had a small sort of informal meeting. And I said there are basically three baskets here. In the first basket, we'll put some nuts and bolts UFO stuff. I said, we can all agree on this. This is something that, you know, the French GIPON is investigating at the moment. And, you know, this is sort of the, if you will, objective UFO stuff. You know, when it comes to radar and sort of hardware, et cetera, we don't need to disagree. But there's two other baskets. In the second basket, we have abductions. And interestingly enough, by the way, the French don't seem to have abductions. They don't have zero abductions, but they have very much many, many fewer than we've been led to believe by the statistics we've done. And the third basket is, I think, in some respects, even the most interesting, even though it's the most controversial, and that's all the connected phenomena, like cattle mutilations or alien hybrids or what I call portal areas. I investigated one at the Yakima Indian Reservation, Washington State, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I think in this area also we would put crop circles and whatever relationship they might bear to UFOs, and probably also the Pennsylvania Bigfoot sightings, which are very difficult to interpret, and certainly it's difficult to dismiss them as simply either hoaxes or something that's just basically only biological.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, so we've got these three different things. Which, you know, what are we going to pay attention to here? And I think the truth is it's the easiest to pay attention to the nuts and bolts and to say the other stuff, well, you know, that's, as you said, French phenomena.
Right.
But intellectual honesty. I spent a lot of time investigating abduction cases. I mean, talking to abductees. So I can't just wave this away and say, well, these people's experiences just don't exist. There are cases like the Allagash abductions where there's just too many people involved, and it just, I just can't throw those cases away and say, well, you know, those aren't real.
Mm-hmm.
So nonetheless, you know, for the North Carolina conference, we're not going to talk about that. And so I think, you know, that's okay if that's what, you know, if that works, that's fine. And maybe we should be like Kemp and sort of hold off on the other stuff. But intellectually, it's not possible to just dismiss abduction reports and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about abduction reports is this is a relatively, I think, intellectually cohesive area. I know many people might find that strange, but given the research that Dave Jacobs and Bud Hopkins did, I think it's indisputable that there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
What the nature of it is, I don't think I can say, but I think it's an interesting, very cohesive area, and may actually hold the clues that tell us why there are UFOs in the first place.
Well, and you know, what's interesting about I think the closest parallel to the abduction would be kind of like because it as far as hidden events go, more along the lines of like the child abuse, in that you have a vast amount of anecdotal information, and it's pretty much purely anecdotal, and so you've got to trust the person that it's happening to. But for instance, with the child abuse, when did the anecdotal information finally become enough where to break the tipping point to be taken serious? And what parallel do you think there is a parallel in abduction where perhaps the anecdotal information will cause a tipping point in that area?
Well, let's go back to the meteorite for a moment. And what it was with meteorites was there were three things involved. First of all, there had to be an indisputable case, a smoking gun case, if you will, which led this to happen. Second of all, there had to be some theoretical explanation. There had to be some way to connect these kinds of experiences to things that were already known. And third, you had to be able to to distinguish the false cases from the true cases. This third criterion is a little bit more subtle, but it was very important because there's lots of things that people claimed about that had fallen from the sky and so forth. Some of them were meteorites, and some of them, as far as I can tell, were not. But those were the three things that had to happen. Well, this was also true with the child abuse stuff. The really critical thing for child abuse, by the way, was the radiologists, because the radiologists would find from their films that there were, for instance, the kids would have bruises in different stages of healing, that bones had been broken at different times. So it's been more than one. Okay. But the interesting thing, again, is that the physical evidence by itself is not always decisive. There has to be, for child abuse case, there has to be what's called a medical history that supports the, you know, the evident signs. And I think this is true with UFOs, too. Until people can say, well, hey, you know, now we can understand why there are UFOs, then it's going to be very difficult to accept UFOs.
Right. And the hard part with that is, and maybe you can help me with this, at least with the science, is that a lot of science is following the data. And maybe following the data in this instance may demonstrate that this phenomena exists. As for why, could be, you know, much further down the road. You need a lot more data to figure that out than just that it exists at all.
Right. Well, I think the issue is connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you connect the dots? So, and I think this is a particular problem for abductions, because people's model of how, if we did have extraterrestrial contact, how it would work is actually very naive and doesn't even reflect human history.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to assume, basically, that, you know, somebody would land on, let's say, the White House lawn or in Central Park or Hyde Park or something like that, and just sort of like you know, in the, as in the movie, the day the Earth stood still, you know, would sort of walk out and say, well, hey, you know, we're from, you know, the galaxy, and, you know, welcome Earthlings. But is that a realistic point of view?
Mm-hmm.
We also tend to, and there's another problem too. When you invoke science, you tend to think about something as a natural phenomenon. Well, natural phenomena, you know, occur whether or not there's an observer. And so the fact is that maybe UFO phenomena are not a natural phenomenon. Maybe they're an intelligent phenomenon. Intelligent phenomena will take measures that natural phenomena won't. For instance, they'll mostly appear at night, which is what UFOs do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a famous quote by Albert Einstein, and the quote is the following. He said, God is subtle, but he's not downright mean. Okay? And I think this is a very important thing to remember, is that when you're dealing with an intelligent phenomena, it may be downright mean. It may do things that an unintelligent phenomena wouldn't do. I mean, meteorites are going to fall whether there's people there or not. But that doesn't mean that an intelligent craft with intelligent beings aboard will show up whether there are people there or not. The observer effect, it can be very important.
Right, and that reminds me of a study done by, I think it was the Planetary Society in Britain a while ago on this phenomena, and they concluded in one of their papers that if it's an intelligent phenomena and it wants to remain hidden, it will.
Absolutely.
And if that is the case, then of course that makes our goal a lot more challenging. If not impossible, at least until it does want to be unhidden.
Right. Well, so that's the problem with invoking the natural phenomena model. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like Chevrolets where they're all pretty much, you know, they all look pretty much the same. If you've got something that's an intelligent phenomenon, it may not have a standard model, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It may not show up, you know, whether or not people are there.
Right.
And it may actually, in some cases, be able to change its form while you're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, again, suggests that, you know, there may be, this is a problem with people's imaginations, you know, because we expect things to be solid. We expect them to be, you know, constant. And a non-natural phenomena, something intelligent, is not going to be constant. And it will behave in a what you might call a strategic way.
Right. So the difficulty comes when, such as this, with these cases where you have this abundance of anecdotal information, but you have a bias, kind of a set bias by the scientific community. On top of that, you have a skeptics community, which is their goal. I mean, their purpose is to be skeptic. I mean, even if we look at global warming, I mean, I think that they got in the way a lot in that at least forming public opinion.
Yeah.
Before they kind of finally stepped aside with the abundance of scientific evidence. But
they haven't stepped aside.
In some cases they have, but still, you're right, not completely. So how do you counter that? What do you think it will take when it comes to these phenomena?
Well, I think you have to have a more sophisticated theoretical approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, if you're dealing with intelligent life, you know, I love the whole SETI community. I think they're doing wonderful stuff. But there is actually a famous article by the ufologist Emmy Michel, who's a radio engineer, by the way, very, very sharp cookie, wrote several books on UFOs. And he wrote a paper called Project Dick. And it was about the attempt of these dogs to determine whether there was an extra canine intelligence. Mm-hmm. Now, dogs, Michel observed, typically tended to communicate by piddling. And so he described them going up to, you know, some member of the French astronomical community and piddling on his shoes, whereupon the academician kicked the dog. And the dog then decided there was no such thing as an extra canine intelligence.
<You
know>? Okay. But the more interesting part of it is that Emmy Michel quoted from several books on SETI, and it said, and they said things like, the aliens then would have to use such and such frequencies to be able to communicate with us. And he said, said, let's pity the poor aliens who haven't read this book by somebody at the Sorbonne or somebody at the University of Chicago, and so they don't know they're supposed to do it this way.
And well, and it brings back to the point of you know, understanding the why, and like you said, if there is a mean God, that it may be beyond our comprehension to understand the why. And I think that's something that the SETI guys really don't get, because they feel that, which is, I think, having a bigger ego than maybe you should, that we'll recognize the motives when we discover them. But to assume that is assuming a lot, I think, of what they even feel is a very advanced intelligence.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you get the SETI guys alone, they will confess that they're doing things like, for instance, I discovered, looking for bases in the solar system of aliens, okay? Well, they don't say those things publicly because that would interfere with their funding. You know, and they covertly read UFO literature, but they can't publicly admit that they, you know, are interested in it. So, you know, we have this phenomenon here. But just as the abduction stuff is pushed aside, so, quote, scientific ufology can proceed, we also have the SETI people who have a dark side, okay, that they don't want to publicly go public with and say, look, you know, here's our real interest. Because that would interfere with their funding. Scientists are not always motivated just by the truth. A lot of times it has to do with, you know, where's the next check for my radio telescope coming from? I think I would point to Carl Sagan, whom I spoke with, by the way, when I was at Harvard. I took a course from him. And he and I had a private conversation about UFOs. I think Mr. Sagan, if he hadn't been in the position that he was in, might have had a very different view to share with about UFOs. And before, by the way, he became a public enemy of UFOs, he published papers in which he described the aliens using the dark side of the moon as a base. I know that because when I was sitting in his office, he was late. So I pulled off a reprint from a pile, and here was a here was this bald statement, okay? This doesn't sound like the Carl Sagan that we got used to later.
Right.
But I think, frankly, there was some academic pressure on him not to take a more extreme view.
Yeah, because, I mean, he talked about it, of course, in his famous series, Nova, and he talked about identifying intelligent civilizations a lot. I mean, it seemed to be a major focus.
Yes, he even talked in his books about, you know, there might be contact in the ancient world with UFOs. Okay? But the truth of the matter is that all of this is very political because it had to do with protecting his, you know, public stance.
So you have worked with MUFON for quite a while, but if MUFON came to you and they said, you know, help us design our strategy, what are some of the points that you would give them?
Well, when I was a sociological consultant for MUFON, one of the things I was concerned about doing was making sure that field investigators understood eyewitness testimony, its strengths and weaknesses, because that was a very important thing. I read up on forensic psychology, basically, to make sure that I was giving people good advice about what they could depend on and what they couldn't. And I think there, you know, if you're going to be a UFO investigator, forensic psychology is a necessary study. You need to understand how eyewitness testimony works.
That's a good point. I mean, I've just finished some courses on it, actually, because I'm finishing up a degree in psychology, and it was shocking to me how unreliable eyewitness testimony really is.
And for the most part, that's true. Nonetheless, like every other kind of extraction of evidence from witnesses, there are some kinds of eyewitness testimony that are much better than others. For instance, if you're looking at an airplane crash, for instance, and you want to know what happened in the air before the plane hit the ground, it turns out that the best observers of airplane crashes are like teenage boys. And the reason is very simple, is that they tend to, you know, they're very interested in the details, but they don't know enough so they can interpret what they see. The big problem with many of us is that we have theories that guide the things that we see. This is a big problem, obviously, with
our biases. People,
yes, absolutely. And in fact, I'm writing a book on the sociology of information about anomalies, and one of the chapters is on the eyewitness. And so I talk about all the issues associated with eyewitness testimony about anomalies. The truth of the matter is, as I pointed out with Claudney, that the meteorite thing, the problem was solved basically because Claudney believed the witnesses that he read.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a fallacy that when you talk about anecdotal evidence, you know, that science doesn't use anecdotal evidence. It does. That's how we discovered via Claudney meteorites. So, but you know, you have to check it with theory. You have to check it with further observations and so forth. But I think that the reality is eyewitness testimony can be very reliable, but it depends on who.
Right.
It depends on when, and et cetera, et cetera.
Now, when you define hidden events, you talk about unknown frequency, which is certainly an issue when it comes to, first of all, you mentioned how the public doesn't really understand the frequency. It's funny because, you know, I've been a MUFON investigator for quite some time, and I remember one news reporter, I think it was even Nancy Grace or something, it was one at MSNBC, and she's like, do you know that there's been, you know, over a dozen sightings so far this year? And it was like, what are you talking about? There's been hundreds. And that at least we've had, you know, reported to MUFON. But even with MUFON, so the media, like you said, doesn't really understand the frequency. When it comes to MUFON, we get a lot of reports, but then they all don't go investigated. So it's difficult to understand the frequency at this point of what are genuine and what are more mundane. But this frequency issue, it would seem maybe the media is covering it more. Do you think that may help?
Well, I in my book, I have another chapter on the media, and there was actually a doctoral thesis written at Northwestern University by Herb Strentz, who did a really marvelous study of the way that newspapers operate, using a lot of the classic research that had been done on journalists and how journalists operate. The reality is that there's no intrinsic measure of how many UFO reports there are, because even MUFON behaves in a variable way over time. And so you just have to, and in the Air Force, when the Air Force was investigating UFOs, it was unbelievably inaccurate in terms of what was going on. So it's difficult to say, well, what's the real frequency of sightings? There's, you know, it's almost impossible to determine what the real frequency of sightings is without a survey. So surveys are actually a very useful tool.
Okay.
And I actually analyzed one of them. It was done by Industrial Research and Development. And, you know, we're running out of time, I realize, so I'm not going to talk about this.
No problem.
But suffice it to say that in looking at the survey, the people who thought they had seen a UFO and the people who thought they might have seen a UFO, the big differentiator is, did they know anybody else who had seen a UFO? If
mm-hmm.
they did, they were much more certain about what they'd seen.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, by a factor of 3, if I recall correctly.
Wow. So when it comes down to the frequency, at least when it comes to hidden events being taken more seriously, it seems like identifying that the frequency is much higher than the bias was or the perception was, it seems the media can help at least shed light in that the frequency of sightings, for instance, is much higher and the quality of the witnesses is much higher than most people assume.
Yes, and especially if you look at people who are trained to do these things. There was a series of experiments by General Mills on balloons, and the Blue Book at one point tried to convince the balloon observers that they didn't know what a balloon really looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Donald Ruppelt actually almost got thrown into a snowbank, this is what he says, because he tried to convince these people in Minnesota that they didn't know, you know, what they were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did for a living, is they, you know, they used telescopes and other things to keep track of these balloons. And they had a lot of UFO sightings. But the Air Force didn't take them seriously at first.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until Ruppel went there and, as they say, almost got ejected from the office that he began to take these reports seriously.
Great.
But it's an, you know, but somebody in Washington can sit there and they can rewrite this. And the if you know anything about Blue Book, they rewrote a lot of sightings.
Right. Well, this has been really interesting. I'm really glad that we got this chance. I'm very excited to see you talk. In fact, I first heard about you a couple years ago. Leslie and I started talking a lot about, because we were talking a lot over the phone about you and how exciting it'd be to have you speak at a conference. And here you are speaking at two. Within the span of like a month here. In June, you'll be in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the Center for UFO Research event. So this sounds great because it's a lot of scientists and more science-oriented. Leslie Kane had a lot to do with putting together the people, so I'm really excited about that one. And then this year in Las Vegas, July 18th through the 21st, you'll be speaking for the MUFON Symposium.
That's right. No, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and hopefully, I know I'll be at one and hopefully both, so I'm looking forward to saying hi.
My pleasure, Alejandro.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ron. He is a really great guy, so I'm really excited to meet him at one or both of these conferences. I know I'm going to one, maybe both. We'll see what happens. But the MUFON conference, of course, you can go to MUFON.com and find out more about the symposium or MUFONsymposium.com. And then for this exciting one in North Carolina, I'm really excited about this because this is new and interesting, and we'll have some more guests that are going to be there on, and hopefully Leslie Kane also. But you can go to CUFORNC.com. to find out more about that conference. That looks like it's going to be really cool. So go check that out. And then, of course, all of the stories that we talked about, you can go to openminds.tv to get more information, to see my interview with Lee Spiegel and to see Spacing Out, which, of course, we're doing bi-weekly now. And you're going to be able to see all of the UFO news being given by Jason and Maureen on Spacing Out. So go to the Open Minds TV YouTube site for that. And don't forget to check out our magazine because we do have a new issue coming out pretty soon. There is a new issue out on the stands right now. So Open Minds Magazine, go to the store and pick it up or subscribe. It's only like, you know, $30 to get it all year long, and it's an awesome magazine. So check it out. Anyway, thank you all so much for listening. Once again, join us next week for another great interview and UFO update. And as always, I like to thank the guys who donated the music. So Caleb Hanks, who did the opening music, and then Two Earth Minutes with the close music, which you're about to hear now. Thank you all. Talk to you next week, people, and adios.